The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Exactly. I didn't have to worry about a thing being in Uganda. I was just a woman. I didn't have to worry about being a black woman at all. I just was.
Oh, but why? Yeah. Oh, but why? Oh, when?
Oh, but why? Like this, I mean, just, is it a, not a curse, not a sickness, not a anything, but is it just a Western black woman existence that we have to just do this all the time?
Hello, everyone. I'm Emmeline Mondo, and this is Mondo Moments. Now, you know the drill. I believe life is made up of millions of tiny moments, and one of our tasks as humans is to be present for as many of them as possible. Well, this was definitely a moment. Now, all of my conversations on this podcast are moments because I adore everyone that I ask to join me. But this conversation was filled with the elements interrupting, we had a connection breakdown, and all the laughter, joy, and lamenting, I guess, that is filled with our friendship. And I wanted to keep all of it in, so it might sound a little different. Even the intro is different. Honestly, I forgot we were recording, and this conversation is like sitting with us in the living room with blankets and popcorn, or being a fly on the wall in our conversation. I love Giselle's vulnerability, laughter, wisdom, jokes, and honestly, I'm just howling with laughter through most of it, so I do hope you enjoy it. Let's get started with the conversation, and you'll see what I mean immediately.
Hi, Giselle, how are you doing?
I'm well, how are you doing?
I'm just so excited to have you. I'm always like thrilled to be speaking to you because you're a joy. Oh, sorry, just some lightning. Oh, can you hear that?
I can. That's exciting.
Wow. Okay. 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 Pause. I'm going to close the window.
Well, get ready for the train that's about to come by, barreling by the house very soon. So
wow. But also, like, the ancestors are in the room. That was...
Come on.
That was a lot of energy. Okay, so I'm just going
to... I'm sorry, how crazy was that thunder? And I think that lightning was an indication of things to come. Let me tell you a little bit about Giselle LeBlue-Gant. She is an actress from New York City. She graduated from the Southern Methodist University with a BFA in theatre and the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama with an MFA in classical theatre. Giselle recently finished her one-woman show, The Year of the Rooster Monk, which had a run in London. And she's also recently appeared on Christmas Hotel, which is on Lifetime Network. She has also been a host on BET on the series Black to Life and the SHIT. She's also been nominated for a Daytime Emmy for her role in the web series Anacostia. Giselle is a teacher, dreamer, creator, innovator. She's also my friend. Let's get into the conversation.
Thank you so much for joining me, Giselle. We had a momentary interruption there of thunder and lightning, but that's cool. Tell me, how are you doing today? You're in LA, right?
No, I'm in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
But I am doing very well. It's a beautiful cold day, randomly. It's cold in California. It's stupid.
London cold? Or what do you mean by cold? Because I know those California colds aren't always like...
It's early morning frost, like in the 50 degrees, like 59 degrees, 60 degrees. I don't know what that is in Celsius because they never taught us that. So good luck.
I
like to do the conversion.
I was about to say, can you translate that into...
Nope.
Okay. All right. Fine. Okay. So COVID, it's 21 and we're like nearly 5 months out of that COVID year. How are you feeling in this moment and after the year that we've had?
I was optimistic at the beginning of COVID. I thought that everything was just going to work out for the better. Like, we're all going to have a spiritual awakening. Like, literally, everyone's just going to emerge from COVID, like dancing, like at the end of The Wiz. Like, I really thought that we were going to sing Brand New Day in the middle of Times Square. And then, then life started to happen for me. And a lot of things happened to really shift my perspective. I thought my perspective was already shifted. I thought I was open and ready to receive, and no. And so when life started to happen and all of these things, you know, I moved from New York, my home, I fell sick, like, you know, death in the family of my grandmother. There was so much happening.
Yeah.
And then I really had to have a spiritual awakening and a shift. And it looked nothing like I thought it would. It felt nothing like I thought it would. Wow. I think I'm in the midst of that right now, just trying to sort of balance everything in terms of my spirit, in terms of practicality, because I am a flighty woman. I will, I do whatever, I feel like, balancing all those things and, seeing what the rest of COVID is going to look like for myself.
Well, I think that spiritual awakenings are interesting because they have been almost romanticized by a wellness community of, sunshine, happiness, peace and love, when actually the real work of spiritual awakening is confronting fears, it's shadow work, it's stepping into that which you have unconsciously ran away from. And I guess the skill of pivoting in and out of that world is sharpened sometimes when you're an actor. Now, you are an actor and many things, a writer, an actor, a voiceover coach, an artist. And I wonder, the pivot and the process of like working through this, what you've called an awakening, how has it had an effect on how you see your work as an artist? Has it been like intertwined with that?
I was forced to sort of confront what I really value as an artist, what I value as a Black woman,
right,
what I value as a citizen of the world and of America. So I had to really sort of reevaluate all of these things in my art. And, at some point I sort of had to feel, I had to sort of ask myself, was the hustle that I was doing in New York, before COVID, trying to do everything and try to be everywhere and, auditioning for a ton of things to get one little thing, one measly little thing, fighting with other people to get one little thing. Is that how I see myself as an artist? Is that what I want? Is that, is that the life I want to lead? And so I had to ask myself that hard question. And I don't, know if I know the answer yet. But at least I'm thinking about it. It's really shifted how I see. I mean, I always knew that I had to create my own work, but I think now it's just like it's staring me in the face. Like, I need to just do that rather than, just be the audition girl that I was. I think I need to open my horizons a little bit more.
So you did, giving yourself credit, you did step into doing that. You wrote a one-woman show, wrote and performed a one-woman show in the, don't pull a face, people who can't see Michelle's face, she's trying to pull a face. It is an extraordinary achievement. And regardless of, look, I've said this to you before privately, regardless of what comes out after the process of completing a body of work like that, you got it out, you got something out. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that piece because it does incorporate your love affair or at least your hometown. I was going to say your love affair with New York, but it's more than a love affair. It's home.
Yes.
There are many layers of what you discussed in the piece, from gentrification to your mum deciding to sell the house that you'd grown up in and move to Ghana, which is definitely a piece that we'll talk about. But all of those themes of great change, of having to again confront fear and find a way to pivot, and then putting that into your work. I really want to congratulate you, first of all, for doing it, but also, yeah, what was the process like to find it in yourself to begin doing that?
The process. It was the process. Sorry, as you say, I'm going to say it like you. The process. It was interesting. It was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be emotionally. A lot more emotional work. I thought by sort of having a biomythography of myself, like, do you know what I mean? Like that I could sort of divorce a lot of my feelings and my emotions about this topic that I was discussing. And I really couldn't. And so when editing came, the editing process with like my director, it was very hard because everything was so precious to me because this was my life. This was, you know, something that meant so much to me. And I was writing this in the midst of moving from New York, moving from the house, like literally like saying goodbye to the ghosts of the house that I've known for so long. Like it was just too emotional. So, you know, and that coupled with, you know, trying to write this piece and it also being all over the place, I think it's something that I might need to revisit, but it was harder than I thought. And now that I have some years behind me since that event, I think I could try my hand at it again and maybe it'd be a little bit more focused.
Does that mean we have another one-woman show by Giselle Gamp coming out? Sips tea, side eye, okay. She's like, I'm not even going to drop what's next. Can we have a little moment for New York?
Mm-hmm.
New York. Because, I mean, I've definitely mentioned it at least three times in, you know, previous episodes, and people who know me will know I've got a love, you know, addiction with it. How are you feeling about your hometown city post-pandemic? You said something to me recently, which was, the line can't leave me now. You said New York is not my Mecca anymore. Not like it's that. And I'd love to unpack that if you know.
Yeah, I thought the sun rose and set on New York. I believed that, you know, as a New Yorker, like I can do anything. Our damn high school, like graduation song was, it's New York, isn't it? If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you, New York. This was our high school graduation song. Yeah. So it's like beat into you that like New York is it. That's it. You've got to make it here. You've got to do that. Yeah. Otherwise, you're a failure. Sort of. That's a little addendum that I put in my mind.
Yeah,
but that's just what it is. And so, you know, I love other parts of the world tremendously. And seeing how New York, well, I'm not going to say that for those who love New York, Emily.
I want you to speak honestly about your, you know, your feelings about it now, because cities change and people change. Yeah. It informs
It currently, I feel that New York is a little, it's not the place that I feel that I can thrive. Because there's a lot going on. It's very commercial, New York. There's less weirdness of New York. I mean, of course, there's New Yorkers are always going to be weird, but just, you know, on a sort of like grander level, there's less weird things happening. And I loved the weirdness of New York. I loved the fact that you can go to little hole in the walls, and they are true hole in the walls started by mom and pops who, you know what I mean? Who have like, I mean, like Yaffa Cafe was one of my favorite places to go in New York. The decor was absolutely disgusting. I mean, it was leopard, 1,000 different variations of leopard.
Yeah.
Right? Do you know what I mean? The couches, the art was just a mess. And it was the coolest place in New York to me. And like places like that closing down. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Being replaced by banks or, you know, a whole bunch of cool, I say in quotes, places that are trying so hard and not actually cool, like things like that. And New York has sort of lost its luster for me in that. And also, you know, just being able to support yourself as a regular Joe Schmo human being in New York has grown harder and harder and harder. And a lot more people are leaving who are just regular folks, not so much artists, not so much, you know, people who have a shot at making millions of dollars, but, you know, it's just regular folks. And, you know, that's what made New York for me. And so there's a mass exodus of all those people. And, you know, I don't blame them. I sort of, I have joined them.
Yeah, you get it. I hear you. And, you know, gentrification and cities changing, it's something that will always happen. And I think in certain periods of time, people are able to come together and push back against systems and establishments. And I think that one of the cities that has suffered the most with capitalism, like on a rampant rise, because it is this heartbeat of like so much, you know, of Wall Street, of money and power, is New York. And I think, you know, we've seen in the past the way artists have pushed back and fought and managed to keep a little bit. But where I'd agree with you is the pause, the COVID like global pause, as I like to call it, made you ask, like, how am I living and how is this serving me? And, you know, I can't deny, even though I still plan to be there, I can't deny that the mentality that I had when I was younger, when I thought I could survive there, I didn't mind too much if I had a sailor kitchen that was not in use. Because I was like, I'll be out anywhere. I didn't mind too much if I had, like, you know, a tiny little room, because I'd be out anyway. And I, you know, all these things that you didn't care about, actually, you grow up. But also the pandemic made you say, are you living well, like, without these basic things? And I think I think all cities will suffer with this question, because London is the same. Like, London is, you know, every Londoner will tell you, if you look at East London, for example, and Shoreditch and Dorset, it is just completely transformed. And there's so little character, so hard to, like, be able to be normal and survive in the centre of London. But I think what you have to balance it out with is if you're able to create a little bit of something that is important for what you find important, then you can, like, you know, see it out. I also think there's something to be said for leaving hometowns. So we both connected on this thing where, like, Giselle's a Harlem girl who loves London. She studied at Central School of Speech and Drama. She has a beautiful London story of when she was a little girl on holiday here with her mom. And she was like, this is my place, I'm going to live here. And she's endeavoured and made a way to be here on several occasions. And the flip reverse is for me, in towards New York and London. So I think that we are women who like to move. As you said, love to move, and we leave our hometowns because we're in search of the next thing. You know, I met you walking down the road in Kampala, so
that's true.
My absolute favorite thing about you. So let's talk a little bit about that, actually. Uganda, you found yourself in Uganda, what year was it? Was it 2015?
Yeah, 15, 16, around there.
Can you talk a little bit about the journey to leave New York for Kampala?
Yes. So it was completely a whirlwind. My friends who I went to Central with, they started a theater company. And my friend, her uncle lived in Kampala with his family. And they have a expat, like, Shakespeare club. It's so weird. Like, it's just so weird. But they did, like, little random Shakespeare plays with all the expats from, like, England who just want to get together and, like, try their hand at, like, Shakespeare. It was so weird. And so she, because she's a director, she decided, she was like, you know what? I want to do something in Kampala. So Giselle, we're doing, Beatrice and Benedict. Jesus, I can't remember the play now. I can't remember anything. This is killing me now. But
I feel embarrassed that we don't know it. Hold on.
I'm embarrassed too, but part of my sickness is my memory. So I'm not going to, I'm going to just give that, pass it off to
Benedict. Much Ado.
Much Ado. We all know this. Anyway, they were doing Much Ado. We went over there to do Much Ado. And she was like, we're doing Much Ado. We want you to play our Beatrice, who was supposed to be Ugandan, has dropped out.
Yeah.
We're over here now. Can you get here in a week? And I was like, yeah, all right. Like, I just was gifted some money like a week before. And I was like, yeah, I can get a ticket. I can do that.
Yeah.
I was the week and we did the show. And then I fell in love with Kampala and Uganda and just sort of stayed another 6 months.
I know. 6 months. I love it. As an African-American woman, has that trip or that thought of going to any country in Africa been on your mind? Had it been on your mind and your heart that you wanted to do it? Because also I think I'm familiar of a lot of African-Americans who want to, but have misconceptions or fears about making the trip to the continent. Right. What was your initial feeling? Or maybe there's something in your upbringing that meant that you didn't even think twice about it.
That's what it was. So both my parents are Afrophiles. They have been to the continent 1,000 times, but never east. Yeah, my dad has been back and forth to Nigeria. He's had 1,000 jobs like I had. Like, he was selling diamonds at one point in Nigeria. He was a campaign manager for some dude, like running for, you know, prime minister. It was just a lot.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My family has been like everywhere. And so just the idea of going to the continent was nothing. You know, and the first time I ever went was my dad was shooting a movie in Rwanda. And I went there with him. Wow. I turned 21, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, because I got drunk on the plane right over because I could. I got really drunk because I was 21. So, you know, being on the continent just seemed like second home to me.
Right.
Doesn't matter where it was, second home, you know. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a blessing that your parents had already begun making that journey. And so you were well informed in it. I was always really curious about just about the ease of being there. Because I'd been traveling back to Uganda for some time and I'd not met, the only Americans I'd met were expats. And they were white expats. I mean, you were too, but they were white, is what I'm trying to say.
Wait, what? Oh, I was like, I thought you said I was white too. I was like, don't.
No.
Don't call me a Mzungu. Don't you do it.
No way. Technically, you know, it's funny because expats, a friend said to me at the time when I was going back to UG, and he was like, yeah, my parents, I don't know why when in conversation with white people, they say immigrants. My parents are expats. Both his parents are doctors. And he was like, you know, they're expats here. But why do we use expats for white people who move to the continent? But, you know, educated Africans who move to Europe are called immigrants.
Oh, girl, we know why. Stop.
But yeah, he put it like that. And I was like, yeah, so technically you're an expat. In UG.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes, I am. I know. And I was using it to my full advantage.
You were rocking it. And I really miss Uganda. What do you miss most about it?
The motorbikes.
Boda bodas.
Kati.
What about a Rolex after a party?
Rolexes. I tried my hand at making one here. And it was really bad.
It doesn't seem the same. I don't know what it is about. I don't know. I think you've got to be like existing in that sort of like heat and that kind of ease for it to feel all right.
And going down to the market like in Gabba and like getting a whole fish.
Fresh fish.
Yes. And cassava and kachumbali and then having a Nile special. That is what I miss the most.
Hey.
When are we going back, Em? My God.
Get me back. Well, actually, you've got a trip coming up, haven't you?
Mm-hmm. Ghana and Tanzania. And it's
TZ is on now, honey. You just dropped that to me now.
TZ is on.
Okay. Wait, so that obviously means Zanzibar is on.
Absolutely. I'm saying a week in Zanzi. And... Emmeline, we must discuss property.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm literally looking at a lot of property in Ghana when I go because I just need to own some land. But I've known this guy for a while. But he is in Tanzania. He is a real estate guy. And he is telling me and showing me all the properties for sale in Zanzibar for...
Why are you just... No, this is a post-pod breakdown, though.
We must on Zanzibar. I know. So this is why I believe in getting a gaggle of friends together buying or doing something with property somewhere else.
Yeah.
So you all can have a summer home.
Yeah.
You can like time share it with each other.
Yeah.
We must do that. I think as a people.
As a people, it's essential. A place to be, a place to breathe. I think this is so important. So we'll continue this after the podcast, because I want to break this down, figure it out. But yeah, a place to be. Recently, I've been thinking about a way of being and like how we've been showing up in this world, and also what, again, 2020 has made us realize about who we are in this moment and like what's important that we do. And I think touching on land is so important, because it's that way of, I guess, a sense of belonging and a sense of like taking off a fight. And I know, obviously, you've grown up in Harlem and you know America inside out. Is there something about 2020 that just made you think enough is enough, hence this property? I mean, this property.
I mean, I've always been threatening to leave America.
For some years.
I've always been threatening. But I think now is just sort of like, it's really apparent to me, because I also, you know, in the very near future, I want to start a family. And so where do I want to start a family?
Yeah.
That's also a very, you know, prominent question in my head. So
I gotta,
you know what I mean? And I know it's not going to be here. I don't want it here. Do you know what I mean? There is something about America right now that doesn't appeal to me, and it's governmental, and just care of the people. And I'm going to be hard pressed to find, you know, any country on this map where they care about their people enough.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? But I just know for me, this ain't it. But, you know, again, it might just be the wanderer in me who wants to try to find something better somewhere else. It could be.
I mean, what do you think about, I often hear people, particularly in the UK, speak about how terrible, I'm using air quotes, America is at the moment. And then I say to them, name me another place in the Western world where you can name over 5 African-American women and over 10 African-American women in positions of power across industry and who are really leading a conversation that's inclusive. And I think America feels hot at the moment because we are in the middle of a global, like, great change. But my response to that is always, name me another place, like even countries on the continent where women are in positions, not just of power, but are really influencing change in the way that they're doing in America. And
I think I would push back on our Western ideals and our Western way of looking at other countries and the news that we get. Because personally, you're right, I don't know, because I'm not exposed to those places. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure in South Africa, there are 11,000, but do I know them?
Yeah, you're right, actually.
Right. I don't know them. Do you know what I mean? Tanzania just had their first female president. I mean, you know, she's probably going to pack her cabinet with a lot of stuff, but do we know them as Westerners? No, because that's over there. That's Africa. It's not over here. It's not, do you know what I mean? What we think of, I don't know. I think it's very, we have to sort of decolonize our news and our minds about what we know. Do you know what I mean?
I think thank you for saying that, because I remember hearing a news story that in Madagascar, the current leader tried to put forward a natural cure that he had discovered for COVID. And it was like, simmer down with that. But what are the numbers and rates of COVID in Madagascar? They're so low. Across the islands, across the Caribbean islands, there's like less than 10 cases of COVID in some places. So you're so right. Like, I'm going on my mind that is drenched in Western news of, like, you know.
But it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm even looking at the news today and seeing how Western news, American news, I will say American news, is covering Israel and Palestine. It's very interesting. I mean, literally, it says like the escalation between Israel and Palestinian militants. And just sort of like, wow, okay. And that's the narrative that we are being fed over here. And if we don't sort of expand our news, expand our minds, expand a whole lot of stuff, we'll get stuck in one narrative. Hence, we don't know other Black women doing amazing things around the world.
Yeah. Because one thing we do know for sure is that Black women will continue to rise wherever you place them. So,
Absolutely.
On it. Yeah, great food for thought. Well, I definitely look forward to our holiday home in Zanzibar that everyone's going to be calling me.
Absolutely. It's going to be overlooking the water. It's going to be amazing.
You touched on a point that I think about as well, which is like family and definitely feeling that even though I'll probably be in the States in the near future, I know that I won't be raising my children there. So yeah, it's an interesting thing to consider.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking about like a lot of, you know, I'm thinking about like minute things like childbirth. Where do I want to have a baby? Mm-hmm. And I mean, literally in a hospital, where do I want to have a baby? And it's not going to be in America. And we have this idea of, oh no, America's have the best hospitals in the world. You have to have a baby here. And sort of like, statistically, for Black women, I'm not going to be having a baby.
That's the same in the UK as well.
Is it really?
We've just had like loads of back-to-back documentaries about it. And it's to do with the medical profession and how, well, many factors, but mostly how they don't believe our pain, you know.
In April 2019, the BBC reported Black women are still four times more likely than white women to die in pregnancy or childbirth in the UK. And in the US, the rate of pregnancy-related deaths among Black women is 3 to 4 times higher than among white women. Dr. Anna Langer, director of the Women and Health Initiative at Harvard Chan School of Public Health in Boston, said, "The reason behind the racial disparities are many and complex. Lack of access and poor quality care are leading factors, particularly among women at lower socioeconomic levels." Lang goes on to say, "There's a bigger problem. Basically, Black women are undervalued. They are not monitored as carefully as white women are. When they do present with symptoms, they are often dismissed." The American Heart Organization spoke with Dr. Allison Bryant-Mantha. She said, "Racism affects so many things before the patient even gets to the clinical encounter. Both implicit bias and structural racism affect how women are cared for in the healthcare system." End quote. The research, data, and voices of Black women prove that our voices are not only unheard, but they are not believed in critical moments of our care.
Yeah, let me go somewhere where they will. I think Black women, we are sort of, again, colonizing our minds to think that there is only one way to do something.
Right.
And it's the Western way.
Yeah.
And again, you know what I mean? I think.
Totally. Like one area of that, we'll finish on the babies and births shortly.
My womb.
One part of that recently, I was speaking with my sister about how in gynecology in the West, the only reason women lay on their backs to give birth is so that men could have a look at what was going on, when really the best position to give birth is to actually be in a squat. So the way that women do have, you know, give birth in the village is that they get into that squat position. It makes sense because the baby then just comes out. And so you're not supposed to be on your back because, you know, it's the change of flow and gravity. And I was like, that is just like a very simple, basic thing that people would easily disregard, but when you look at the practical nature, instinctive view of that, it's like, why are we lying on our backs to do
exactly what are we doing?
And you know, like, just think about how like the breath and the like push that you get when you're in that squat, lower squat position.
And what's even sadder is that, could you imagine trying to stand up in a hospital bed? Or like all the doctors around you, like, actually, I want to squat. They're gonna be like, lay your ass down. You're not squatting anything. We're gonna pull this baby out of you.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah, fascinating.
Thank you for this baby talk. Thank you so much.
Well, the other thing I'm thinking now about, and I think this question for everyone is so up in the air because, you know, what the hell is anyone doing? But in terms of I want to ask a question about, you know, how you might create in the future, what you're thinking about creating and or just being a part of, what's inspiring you and what's moving you as an artist, or what's inspiring you as, you know, Miss Giselle Gant, what should I do post 2020? Because I think it could be anything.
I'm actually in a place that I am not really inspired. Ooh. And that's what's really sad. I think I'm mourning my inspiration right now. Mm. I am just in a place of consumption, and I'm consuming a whole lot of data and consuming a whole lot of content. And I'm just sort of like, I'm very clear about what I don't like.
Yeah.
I'm very clear about what's cute, but I don't really know. I am having trouble seeing how I fit in.
Right.
In this moment. And so in this moment, thank you, Emily, in this moment. So I have to, so I think when I go back to Ghana, it's really going to be a chance for me to really explore that for myself. Ghana is going to be a real fun and yet quiet time for myself to sit with myself and my art. And that is my aim. And that is my, that's going to be my purpose when I go out there.
Yeah.
It's all vastly uninspired.
I mean, we're also in a pandemic.
True. That's very true.
It's fine how you're feeling. And, you know, I read something recently. I don't know if you've come across this word, but psychologists were sort of bringing it forward as something for us to bring into our lexicon, which is the word languishing. This was in the New York Times. And to languish is to be in a state of non-event or feel unsuccessful. And so when people say, how are you? And you say, I'm languishing. It's just this nothingness. And apparently this is going to be like the number one feeling in 21. And I was like, I'm going to learn that word.
Because, yes, thank you.
Because it's like, even I like saying it, languishing. I guess I'm just bringing it forward to say it's fine to feel uninspired at the moment because we're moving out of something. And as you said at the beginning of the pod, you've gone from a move, you know, lost your grandma, like had news about your health that you're now working through. And it's like, there's so much information to process.
Yes. But I think what being an artist as well, and an artist in a competitive sort of field as sort of this, you know, acting is, you also feel behind the eight ball. You also feel that there are other people creating. They're getting so much done. People are doing so much. They're actually getting rich in this time. What am I doing? I'm not doing anything. I'm sitting here like with a bottle. I literally have a bottle of wine on my desk and just looking out the window. What am I doing? And I'm not producing. And this feeling of that I'm not producing. So ergo, I'm not viable and I'm not, do you know what I mean? I'm not.
And what, you know, can we just name the system that makes you feel that if you're not producing or viable, you're not valuable?
Capitalism, absolutely.
What's that system we're trying to break down?
Yes, this was a teachable moment by Emily Mondo.
You know, yeah, I mean, we all do it. We're all there. Yeah. I think one thing everyone will say is that everyone's had that feeling of like, oh my gosh, they're doing so much. They're being so productive. They're getting this and that done. And I think it's just, it's waves and it's process. And it's about compassion, right? Finding a way to be kinder to ourselves as much as we can. I think both you and I have learned that we have to be in that way. Especially in the industry, well, in the film and television industry, which we're both like, am I even in it?
Am I even in it? Am I still considered an actor?
Let's unpack this because it's it's awkward and like sweet and like hopeful. No, look, I think I said this to you again off the record, like to me, you're an artist and always an actor. And the lesson for me in 2020 was remembering who I am, actually, remembering that by nature, I'm a storyteller. By nature, you are a storyteller. And that's a part of our calling that's actually non-negotiable and actually not up for debate. Like we can debate how successful we are. We can debate whether we're doing it or not. We can debate whether it's good or not, but we're storytellers.
That's true.
So
that's
let's round that off nicely.
Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Yes, we are storytellers.
We are, but it's a very real like struggle, fear and challenge to feel like one, to feel worthy when you're not actually doing it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the process of acceptance in that? Are you getting any better at it?
Am I getting better at it? No, I think because I'm just generally just hard on myself. I'm not getting any better at it, but I think I know that in this present moment right now, how I'm with myself and how horribly I talk to myself about certain things. But I also know that in the next moment, I have the ability to change that. And so it's just being, allowing myself to be in those other moments where I am being nicer to myself, I guess, and talking to myself in a better way and just sort of thinking outside of the box and being more optimistic. I think that's the struggle I'm having right now is to have more of those moments.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'll get there and I'm sure I'll get there in Ghana.
Yes. Yes. I believe that. How has your Buddhist practices helped you with that? Are you still practicing or spirituality? How's that sat in acceptance?
I think because I was born Buddhist and grew up Buddhist, the way I think about things are very Buddhist. Now, the practice of it, I'm lazy. So I'm not, I mean, my practice has gone to the wayside. Yeah. But the thinking and the thought processes and the tenets of Buddhism are always there in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
For example, the ability, what I just said, the ability to change moment to moment.
Yeah.
That's very Buddhist. Yeah. And that's just inherent in me. Now, whether I actually get up in the morning and do and chant, no. I mean, I'm just lazy. But do you know, but I know I can always call back to that. And always the Buddhist sentiment, always the Buddhist tenets are there within me.
So. Yeah. You know, I think it's beautiful to just recognize that they're always there with you because I kind of feel that about grace and spirit, right? Like I might forget to pray sometimes or might forget who I am, you know, this infinite channel of like energy and like divine light within me, I forget. You know, we forget every day. But because I've known it, it never leaves me.
Because
we've known it once before, it actually never leaves. And it's always just there waiting for you to allow it to hold you and guide you. So
exactly. And I think, you know, you might have moments of slip up, but those slip ups last, you know, they're shorter and shorter. For example,
yeah.
I mean, last night I had a complete breakdown, and my mother was like, "Oh my god!" And I was like, "Just get out the phone with me," because I was sort of lamenting or languishing. There it is,
languishing,
and just sort of like bemoaning my state of like not being artistic, not being sort of where I feel I need to be in life, and that lasted all of 3 minutes, which is an accomplishment for me. I had to call my mom back, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm over it now. Like I've gotten my little tantrum out. Thank you." But do you know what I mean? Because they're the same with depression. Once you understand who you are and where you're going and what you're about, those moments, those slip ups are, you know, become less frequent and they become shorter and shorter, which I'm so thankful for.
Yeah.
Because who I was even last year is different than who I am now. Because I just had to realize a couple of things about myself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the shit sometimes. So I got to just hang on to that.
This is true. This is true. I read somewhere recently about, Tara Brach said, like, the spiritual life is a process of remembering and forgetting. So it's literally like you forget who you are. You remember, oh, I'm great. Oh, my God. I'm amazing. Oh, shit. So once you know that, you know, let yourself have that moment, be fully in it, like have the breakdown, the tears if you want, and then come back into that knowing. But I don't know. I love us as, you know, there's a specific way that Black women are. We're just on a particular ride, you know, and the way that we have to keep coming back can feel so exhausting, but
yes,
we continue to do it so well. And I do think it's specific to us, like, specific to the ways that we're here and the way that we continue to be here.
Yeah. Do you find that is, I'm trying to frame this question where it doesn't sound like complete stupidity, but do you find that in Western Black women, there is more of a need for being a daily phoenix, really, like rising from the ashes daily? Or is a Western Black woman thing, or do you think it's just a global Black woman thing?
Being a Phoenix, first of all, let's create some space for that. Does a Western Black woman feel the need to be a daily Phoenix? I absolutely love it. And that is just such a great question, babe, because I think you're asking that from the knowledge of a very glorious way in Uganda, like, oh, well, why? A woman is being, and it's money, like, welcome
the fact that I didn't have to, exactly, I didn't have to worry about a thing being in Uganda. I was just a woman. I didn't have to worry about being a Black woman at all. I just was.
Oh, well, why? Yeah. Oh, well, why? Oh, well, when?
Oh, why? Like this, I mean, just is it a, not a curse, not a sickness, not a anything, but is it just a Western Black woman existence that we have to just do this all the time?
A product of the system. Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's certainly a way of being that we in the West, we Black women in the West could lean more into, but I know why we don't. So I do actually think it's, they're two different glow ups, right? Yes. Both are valid. Like, I'd rather the latter. Absolutely. I think you're about to sit in it in Ghana, which is like this very, it's a knowing, right? When you're on the continent, in the motherland or in your homeland, where, as you say, you're just not thinking, you don't realize what you've been carrying until you get into a country where everybody looks like you and you're not even thinking about it. You don't realize how heavy it's been until you're on it.
Oh my God.
So I'm,
that is a word. Yes.
It is. And I'm glad that you mentioned that because when I started going back to Uganda and it was around the time that I met you, I was like, light on my, that was a bang.
You were.
I was
you and these Gota Gotas with your hats just literally flying down the street. Hats,
like, you know, I was throwing things on in a really, like, I do love to throw on a look, but actually in UG, I literally did not care. And it was, and I'm like, oh, this is the carefreeness that white girls are having, like, on, you know, in these, like, Chelsea streets. And I was like, okay, I get it.
Or and, on the continent, let's be real.
Yeah,
they're having that carefreeness. And I'm just sort of like,
yeah, they really are. So in the West, I think the way that we come back from the glow up is, it is intertwined with like, you didn't think I'd come back, did you? But here I am and I look better than you and I look good. And then it still feels good. Whereas in UG, I feel like the regular woman can like step out in a little get a little chapati here, like basically not do too much and be everything and enough. And I'm jealous.
Me too. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We don't have to do the most to be valuable and enough.
Exactly. And I feel like we have to do this all the time. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting. Why? But also it's something that we, but there's also something beautiful in that. I don't know what it is, but it's beautiful.
The beauty is that we achieved the glow. No, it's so sad. It's kind of sad as well as I giggle.
It is. That's why I was like, is it beautiful? I mean, I guess in a sad way.
The beauty is that we find a way to make it look good when actually the truth of the experience that we're having is that the fight back from our like lows are wild. I mean, it's otherworldly.
Yes.
Like who's coming back from these points, these minuses, all the bank accounts, minus, minus. Where's my next job? Don't know. Where's my partner? I don't know. It's a no. Then suddenly you're like, honey, I'm back.
The Phoenix, honey, literal ashes.
Like, how did you like,
How did you do it? And I think we have to sort of pat ourselves on the back because every single Black woman who lives in the West does this. And so we are kind of brilliant for that.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
My friend had to remind me the other day. He was like, Giselle, I don't know how you do it, but you always bounce back from something. Like, and I'm just like, oh yeah, I do. Like, it was just, yeah. But the shit is exhausting.
Yeah.
It's like standing, it's being on a trampoline all day, every day, yeah, for the whole of your life. Like, that's exhausting.
And we don't even realize that afterwards. It's funny because I think that of you, I always think, wow, like you always bounce back. But I remember someone saying to me as well, oh, you always land on your feet. And I remember thinking, I don't, like, why am I always falling? Like,
exactly. What's happening? Can I just stay on my feet, please? Can I just stay here?
Can I just like always be walking well? Like, why is it always, always, do you know what I mean? It's like,
exactly. And that's how I feel right now. Like, I feel like I will land on my feet, but I am still up in the air, or I'm jumping right now. I'm not even coming down. Like, I'm not even like about to land. And it's so annoying for me to have to keep doing this, to have to keep rising again from the ashes. I'm tired of this. Can I just burn brilliantly, please, for a while?
Can we keep the light on? Yeah, do you think there's something about the length of this pause that while we can feel grateful for the stillness, actually for us, it's like longer to stay with the wounds. And so the healing, like one could argue that this amount of stillness for us in some ways is actually like an opening and a look at so much that we had just been pushing on with.
Absolutely. I think it's necessary. And I feel like we wouldn't have I'm just speaking about Black women. I don't think that we would have been given such a reprieve in our lifetimes ever. Like, ever. We would have never had a chance to breathe like this. And whether we took that chance or not, I mean, some of these girls have been hustling since, you know, the first cough last December, the December 4th. This is the first person coughed. They have been working and turning it out and doing everything amazingly.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
But for all of those other ones, I think it's a real good time. But I mean, even in that, they have discovered something about themselves, haven't they? Mm-hmm. That they could turn it out, make it work. Start a business,
right?
Do whatever, you travel, whatever. That's great. That's amazing. You've discovered that about yourself. And I think for the other ones of us, we're discovering other things about ourselves that may not be so pretty,
right?
But that need to heal, and we need to heal a lot. So hopefully, this is a time for us Black women to really heal. Because once you know, even when you're sick, for example, they tell you, take that extra day or week or whatever to make sure that you're healed, because then you're going to come back 1,000 times. You're going to come back swinging. And I feel like Black women are going to come back swinging.
Right.
Hard. Right. Knocking it down. But we need to take this time to heal, honestly, and be honest with ourselves, so we can come back and just rule the world like we can do.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, really poignant. That moved me as you said it, because it's... there are different pockets of us like leaning into the different lessons and the teachings. And actually, I think both sides are equally hard, whether you kept it going, turning stuff out, or you're, like, you know, pushing stuff out, or you're sitting with that healing. Yeah, my honest hope is that enough of us did really stop and allow it, because I think you're right in that I can't think of another time that, like, globally and as a society, we would have been given the spaciousness to. But I recognize that it's a privilege to be able to also, you know, make that choice.
Absolutely. I was going to say the exact same thing. It's a wonderful privilege that a lot of us haven't been able to experience, and probably won't ever again. I think even in our lineage, in our 7 generations, I don't think we'll be able to have this reset again. Yeah. So I really pray that we took the time to do whatever we felt was necessary for our healing, so that we can go forward and be amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Mondo Moments. If you're enjoying these conversations, please remember to like, subscribe, and share. And you can leave comments either on my social media or on the review button on the app that you're listening to. I'd love to hear what you think. Thanks for tuning in, and we shall be having more conversations very, very soon. Bye-bye.